Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
You know, as a producer, any company or organization that you're involved with, or anyone that you possibly purchase an input from, or whether that be crop protection tools, data, equipment, or maybe you're a member of the wheat growers, or you're a member of the corn growers, or American soybean, or the sorghum, national sorghum producers, we are all there basically in one room.
Chandler Gould, National Association of Wheat Growers on Commodity Classic.
And then we also have educational sessions. Each of the organizations have meetings there. We all have a booth. Next year is also going to be the National Association of Wheat Growers 75th anniversary, and so we're going to have a big to do at our booth there, celebrating the 75 years of representing the wheat growers at the Commodity Classic in Denver, Colorado, that first weekend in March.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
It's a generational bad.
The ranking member of the Senate Ag Committee is a senator from Arkansas, Dr. John Bozeman, on the ag economy.
Every farmer, not every farmer, but most farmers that I visit with, unless you're in the animal side of things, it just doesn't pencil out. Their input costs are so high, about 30% higher than they were in 2019. But along with that, you've had the bottom fallout of the commodity prices. And so as a result, you know, they're working hard. Sometimes they've got great crops. Sometimes they've got average crops. But no matter what it is, it just doesn't pencil out. Their input cost, the cost of production is higher than what they're going to receive for their crops. So it's a it's something that is imperative that we do our job, get a farm bill passed, and then also I think we're going to need some help as far as economic disaster type aid.
He admits that yesterday's solutions might not solve today's problems.
People talk about the 2018 farm bill being a great farm bill, and the 2018 farm bill was a really good farm bill for 2018 and 2019. It was based on 2012 data. The world is totally different now than it was then, since the inflation started in March of 2021 and the breakdown of the supply chain as a result of the pandemic. So no, the current farm bill just simply doesn't work anymore. It wasn't designed for the high input costs that we're seeing now. And also, nobody really anticipated the dramatic decrease in commodity prices. The other problem is that as we look forward, we've got some great land-grant institutions in our country that we can be so proud of. It doesn't matter who you talk to, whether you talk to those economists, our economists, USDA's economists. Most people don't feel like the farm economy, as far as commodity prices, is going to get any better anytime soon. So because of that, we simply have to put more farm in the farm bill. By that, I mean we just have to update it so that it actually works for producers faced with the situation that they're in now.
But maybe some of the issue and the problems are coming from a lack of trade and a trade deficit for ag.
About 40% of the product in Arkansas is exported. That would be true throughout the country. In order for agriculture to be successful, we have to consider that we've got one customer in the United States, and we've got thousands of customers throughout the world. And it's really sad, Tony, because right now, no one wants to put all their eggs in the Chinese basket. The whole world is looking for reliable, stable partners. We are that. We got a lot of problems, but we are reliable. We are stable. And yet we're simply not working any trade deals. We're not working on keeping the trade deals that we have this current administration, and we're certainly not creating any new ones. So as a result of that, trade has been a real negative for the last 3.5 years. So it's something that we have to turn around in the farm bill, in my view of things, in my framework, in GT's written bill. Both of us want to significantly increase the programs that we give for farmers, give for groups, to encourage trade and build trade in the future. The administration simply is not doing that.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Certain species are sensitive to some of those kinds of stressors.
Dr. Jason Smith is a Texas A&M AgriLife Extension beef cattle specialist on feeding through drought.
So if we're going to be feeding a warm season annual, so whether that's sorghum, Sudan grass, a hybrid of those, Johnson grass, we are going to have some nitrate and prussic acid risk. That doesn't mean that all those forages are going to be a problem. Likely the majority of them will not be. But we really don't have a good indicator of their risk if we don't test them. And so I want to recommend that if, say, for example, if we're going to be feeding a hay that's of a sorghum variety, we test that for nitrates and prussic acid to ensure that to try to prevent an issue before it becomes one. This is not, I want to be clear in saying this isn't a reason to avoid those forages, incredibly valuable and useful forages for us here, especially in this part of the world. But those are just risks that we need to be mindful of and manage them. Testing is as a starting point for most of us in doing that. We also need to be mindful of some of our grazed forages and in situations where maybe we're grazing a forage that's been grown on some ground that's received some really heavy nitrogen fertilization. There's certain conditions that are going to favor the development of or the accumulation of nitrates that may or may not be problematic. And so we just need to be mindful of those things, especially some of our weed species. If we look at grazing out crop fields, whether it's residue or it's a droughted out crop or something like that, a lot of our weeds that we say are toxic weeds, many of them are toxic because they're nitrate accumulators. And so we just need to be mindful of those risks and then manage them.
But Charles Hoard is Executive Vice President of the Tennessee Cattlemen's Association on benefiting from extended grazing.
One of the things we shared in this week's Monday memo that just got sent out was the five additional counties in Tennessee that are now eligible for the USDA FSA drought assistance after being declared in a D3 or extreme drought. You know, that kind of timely information could be pretty important for producers. But I also want to bring that up because one of the things TCA did not too long ago, well, it was about 10 years ago, I guess, was we worked to get the grazing period in Tennessee expanded through the USDA FSA office. That may not sound like a big deal, but we basically got it extended from where it ended in November 1 to now it ends in December 1. So what that means is if we enter into a drought in the fall like we did last year, a number of counties got that D3 status, that extreme drought status in November. And because that was still in our grazing period, a number of producers got qualified for disaster aid. And it came to about $25 million in 2023 that producers got because we worked to extend the grazing period in Tennessee that extra month. A little background on that is a former president of TCEA, Gary Daniel, down in Lawrence County, or Wayne County, I should say, back in 2013 when we had that similar late season drought, he saw producers in Alabama receiving federal dollars where producers in Tennessee did not because their drought season or their grazing season was already extended to December 1, where ours was not. So he got to work on that on behalf of cattle producers. The Cattlemen's Association got to work on that to get that extended. So we also got additional money in 2013 and 2014 when we had some of those late season droughts, another additional about $25 million to producers. So that's just one of the things TCA has done here that producers may not know about, but it really paid off quite a bit when you think about the money that flowed into Tennessee cattle producers from those droughts.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
You're preaching to the choir with us. It's others we have to convince of things. You know, I'm glad I live in a country with safety nets, but we got to make sure they're working.
At a recent House Ways and Means Subcommittee hearing on investing in a healthy America, Ohio Representative Brad Winstrup, that's Dr. Brad Winstrup, on sleep, activity, and nutrition.
And, you know, in medicine, as you all know, there's the risk of bad luck. No one necessarily knows why they got the glioblastoma. But there's also the risk of bad behavior, and that we can have something to do with. You know, when we talk as a government, as a here, we talk about success being how many people you'll have enrolled in a program. And you're not checking whether the program's really working or not. Instead of looking at, hey, we've got more people healthy than ever before in America. Wouldn't that be great? You know, our goal, we keep talking about being the healthiest nation on the planet. And we can't do things like in SNAP. Okay, I'm glad we have programs to feed people that can't feed themselves. But what are we feeding them? And you know, they say things like, rather than focusing on calories or nutrition, they focus on calories. And when we say, well, we should restrict it, and these are the foods that people should be able to get in these programs. And the response we get up here, well, rich people get to buy those foods, so that's not fair. Well, not life isn't fair, but we're trying to make life better. And so, you know, just talking about obesity, I was doing an interview about a year and a half ago, and it's like, it's terrible. There's such a stigma against obesity. And I said, no, the stigma is against those who want to talk about it. And we're turning that around. That is changing. And it's thanks to all of you and some people here. You know, with the Army, I was teaching a class called the Performance Triad, and it was about sleep, activity, nutrition, right? And we talked about, and it was referenced here, we can keep people alive for a long time in this country, but can we keep them healthy for a long time? And even those with chronic diseases, can we make you as healthy as you possibly can? So you can live the best life that you might be able to. So I'm just grateful you're all here. And I just want to share some things. You know, I've said for a long time, I said, yeah, we reward the doctor that does a coronary bypass graft, but not the doctor and the patient that prevent it from ever happening, right? We got to look at those types of things, and that's what really success is. And what are the root causes? You talk about social determinants of health. We had a rural and underserved healthcare task force, because rural and underserved areas, they got the same problems, basically. So, I mean, I had a patient one time, diabetic, end-stage renal disease, neuropathy, trying to prevent him from ulcerating over and over again, and he says to me, I can't come to you anymore because they changed my bus schedule. And I said, well, I'm going to change my schedule then, so you can get in here. Those are things we have to address, you know, at the local level and whatever. And Dr. Rinaldo, I think it's some. We have one of our hospitals. When I went to their free clinic, they also have a food bank with nutritious food there. And so this is the way. But they said more people show up for their appointments because they know they're going to leave with food. And so we had another really nice FQHC, and a new large food bank was going in next door. I said, build a sidewalk. Well, they did, and they put a gazebo in. And I said, so people do that. I said, you know what else you might do in here, though, is have local employers post jobs that they have available. But all of these things are very holistic and rounded.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Always comparison shop. The pricing for metals is available online, and you should look to the online price to see if you're getting a fair deal.
John Mark Baffa is Assistant Chief of the CFTC's Office of Cooperative Enforcement.
Since metals don't move that quickly in terms of price appreciation, if you overpay, it may take you decades to recover your money. The second thing is to remember that many of the online sellers are not reputable. Instead, you should look at local businesses, people who have a track record of success, big box stores, the United States Mint. Those organizations tend to offer you a fair price, and that's where you want to start. Never be afraid to ask questions. It's important to understand what you're buying and why you're buying it. If you're not sure, do your homework, because homework can save you from making a bad investment.
Vice President Kamala Harris and President Donald Trump have provided answers to the latest American Farm Bureau presidential candidate questionnaires. Joby Young, Executive Vice President for the American Farm Bureau, says the survey is a key tool for rural Americans.
The presidential election is an opportunity for every American to cast their vote and voice their opinion on the direction they hope the country goes. And for more than 40 years, AFBF has asked every presidential candidate in the general election to provide responses on issues that are likely to impact farmers and ranchers in rural communities. We receive responses and we share those responses unedited so that our members and any interested voter can decide for themselves what they think about the answers that they hear from the presidential candidates.
The survey contains 14 questions and covers a broad array of topics.
Everything from crop insurance to taxes to agricultural labor to sustainability. We also ask questions about regulatory reform, food system resiliency, energy, biotechnology. We got responses from both the Harris and Trump campaigns, and we've taken their answers and we've made them available to view.
Young says AFBF is in a unique position to present this type of information.
We know what's important to them, the issues that affect rural communities and that affect farm and ranch families. So we formulate those issues into specific questions, these 14 questions that cover those issues, like I mentioned, crop insurance, taxes, labor, sustainability. And this gives us an opportunity to present those directly to the candidates and the candidates to hear those questions and understand what our members and folks across rural America and the farm and ranch community care about and respond in their own words.
For more information, go to fb.org/election2024. With elections looming, the congressional calendar is tight. Right now, Congress is locked in a funding battle. Emily Buckman, Director of Government Affairs for the American Farm Bureau Federation, says the deadline is quickly approaching.
Well, September 30th marks the end of fiscal year 2024. This means Congress has roughly 2 weeks to pass government funding legislation to avoid a government shutdown. The activities of most federal agencies are generally funded on an annual basis through the enactment of regular appropriation bills. So the annual appropriations process governs the discretionary portion of the federal budget. To date, the House has passed a handful of individual funding bills, and the Senate has not passed any.
Buckman says that at this point, a continuing resolution is likely necessary to avoid a shutdown, but the two chambers are at an impasse.
Well, the House and Senate have not agreed on how long they would like a continuing resolution to be. The House of Representatives is expected to consider legislation that would fund the government through March 2025. Now, on the other side, the Senate would like to see a shorter continuing resolution that would punt the discussion into December. It is an election year, and the congressional calendar is very limited.
She says government funding is the first step in getting to work on a growing list of must-pass legislation.
Time is limited for the rest of the year to take up legislation, which is why it's imperative that Congress funds the federal government beyond September 30th so that we avoid a government shutdown and allow for work on other efforts, including passage of a new farm bill. Updating the farm safety net to help farmers manage risk is necessary for America's food supply.
Chad Smith, Washington.
Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
And that's nothing to take away from wool. Wool is a tremendous natural fiber, and even as a textile standpoint, wool clothing is very popular.
Dr. Jake Thorne is a Texas A&M AgriLife Extension livestock specialist on the value of sheep.
However, the value of the wool off the farm or ranch has really not necessarily kept up with the times and not really kept up with the prices of those products, the retail market. And so producers, you're right, are more focused on lamb production maybe than ever. And the Dorper breed of sheep is really popular in the state of Texas. It does not, or actually does grow a little bit of wool, but it loses that wool, it sheds it, and it is strictly for meat production. But Dorpers are prolific. Lambs are vigorous, they grow fast, and so a producer with one Dorper ewe or multiple Dorper ewes can expect to have 150 or a 200% lamb crop from those lambs in perfect conditions, and that means that you're going to sell a couple lambs for every ewe, and you're right, the value of those lambs is really increasing, and really from an economic standpoint, it makes a lot of sense.
One aspect sheep raisers like about the industry, it's a quick turnaround.
I would say about 75 to 90 days is probably a pretty common age for those lambs to run with the ewes, and then they're weaned at that time point. And often, especially with Dorper and hair sheep that are becoming more popular, they're going to go into a slaughter channel not too long after that weaning time period. And so that turnover is quite fast. And that's really one of the benefits of sheep production, is not only from a generational turnover, if you're a breeder and trying to improve your genetics, you can increase your, you can keep back a number of ewe lambs and they're ready to go right back into production, but you have a sellable product in just a few months after lambing.
Now, for a cattle producer looking to add sheep production, there are some differences.
Traditionally, we would say that one cow is equal to one animal unit, and that's a stocking measurement, how many animals you can put on a certain pasture or range. The equivalent for sheep, and specifically for Dorpers, is six Dorpers or six mature ewes for one cow or one animal unit. And so, and, you know, every operation is different, and every operation keeps their books, and their economics is dependent on some different factors. But essentially, if you're a producer trying to make the decision, should I include sheep or should I go to sheep, you can use that ratio as somewhat of a comparison for how many livestock you can have on a certain amount of land that you've got.
And it's almost impossible to make an apple-to-apple comparison.
Full transparency is one of the reasons why there maybe historically hasn't been as many sheep, or something that people really need to consider. They are more management heavy than cows. They're not quite as resilient to some certain issues. And two of those big issues that we have in sheep are predation and parasites, as you mentioned. And so there's some different strategies of research, and extension is really working on educating producers, the best deworming protocols to try to limit the troubles with parasites, which can be really problematic. And then also predation, mainly from coyotes, is a challenge. Livestock guardian dogs are one of the real key factors in a sheep operation to keep coyote predation at bay. Those are becoming more popular, especially as we learn more about and kind of hone in our protocols for developing those guard dogs, going through the training process and making them effective protectors. But if you can get those two things worked out, predators and parasites, you're really two steps ahead of everyone else from a sheep production standpoint.
And this is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The numbers that were published by the USDA in terms of cattle on feed came pretty darn close to what expectations were pre-report.
Bob Maurer, Manduka Trading, Chicago.
So the on-feed count up 0.6% year-on-year. Placements down 1.4% year-on-year. August marketing's down about 3.5% year-on-year. And again, those were pretty much what the trade had been discounting going into the report. What was more so, I think, important was that the way things set up for last week was, I think there was some anticipation for the report, and I also think there was some anticipation in terms of some of the grain data that may have come out last week, and that pretty much put the pause on the cattle market for the first half of last week, and then the second half started to light up with some pretty good moves to the upside on the cash side of the equation for the cattle marketplace. So the five-day weighted average for the week last week ended up being about 183.60. That was up about $1.65 from the previous week, so that's a good thing. And then in terms of the cattle sold out there in the U.S. on the northern side, it was sold for mostly about 290 towards the end of the week, which was $2 higher week on week. And then the southern live cattle were roughly around primarily 183, which is anywhere from $2 to $3 higher week on week. So I think it was more so a driver of just what was happening out there with cash fundamentals and the fact that cash bids did what they did, and that the packers came in apparently a little bit short bought and had to do some business in order to keep the throughput moving along. The thing that kind of sets up to work against any irrational exuberance to the upside, shall we say. I'm not saying it's necessarily going to top off or it topped off today, but talking about the D's live cattle futures, is that the box beef cutout was lower. It ended up around $300 or so. That was down about almost $5 week on week. So basically the margins are getting squeezed for the packers, and they're just going to have to figure out how to massage their way out of that. Could be that, you know, they need to reduce the throughput to the best they can. Could be that they need to pause buying the best they can. Could be that they try to kind of buy things out a little bit more forward, less hand-to-mouth, shall we say. So we'll just see how they want to massage that. We'll be watching that closely and see what the cash market does this week. Zipping back, though, to the cattle on feed report, again, the highlight numbers were a bit of a yawner. But when you kind of dig into it, I think there's a couple stories that are being told there. If you can take the one data point, we need to see if this becomes a new trend. But so far through August, the cow slaughter has decreased by about 14.8% at about 3.8 million head in that August number. And the beef cows accounted for a larger decrease of about almost 16% than dairy, down about 14%. So we're seeing a bit of a decrease in the pace of the cow slaughter. We'll see if that has any kind of short-term indication on any consistency, we shall we say, in terms of the herd building. And on the flip side of that, when you dig into the data for the cattle on feed in terms of weights, we're seeing that the year-over-year increases continue to increase. So we've got fatter cattle out there. So that kind of tells us, as an offset to potentially the cow slaughter being down is that the weights are higher and we're getting product out of that way, from that mode anyway. Meaning, for the month of August, gains for steers were up 3%. Heifers were up, this is weight gains, that is, we're up 3% for steers, heifers up around 2.7%. Cow weights up 1.1% and calves up around 16.4%. So we got heavier weight cattle out there, and obviously that translates typically into more production down the road, depending on what their life cycles, you know, where they're at in their life cycle and such. So we'll see how that plays out. And those are a couple of pieces of data. We'll see if they become trends that came out from the Cattle on Feed report besides the marquee numbers.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Last week's farm income forecast from USDA reflects what Chief Economist Seth Meyer calls a cost-price squeeze and part of the cyclical nature of farm economics.
We go through these periods where we have a shock in the market. Prices jump. Input prices follow them. As farmers do what they do best, which is produce their way through it, those prices fall and input prices tend to remain sticky. So we go through these periods. We saw it in the 2007-08 period. We saw it in the 2010-13 period. And followed by a number of years of pretty tight margins.
The chief economist at this week's AgriPulse Ag Outlook Forum in Kansas City acknowledged that a tighter margin situation for producers seems to be developing at a faster pace than what he saw during the last farm income forecast in February. Although market shocks, such as those created by the Ukrainian conflict or global pandemic, could lead to higher prices for commodities. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.